Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. I saw this report. Now, it's an older report back in August from the Treasury Department. And it's said, you know, something that I've said for a very long time. It's titled Labor Unions and the Middle Class, but their conclusion that strengthened unions have the potential to stem or reverse some of the negative trends that have faced the middle class since the 70s. Been saying that, well, for all 18 years of doing this little program. They point out that stagnant wages, deteriorating retirement benefits, decreased leisure time, all that stuff can be reversed, and that unions raise wages, they raise fringe benefits and other things for members to do better. And here's the other part, talk about this as well. There's a spillover effect that leads to similar improvements for non-union workers. This is that rising tide thing that we've heard about with the boats. Maybe you heard this. This is when we do better. We do better. And I couldn't help as I was reading through this, and there's a lot. These reports are very dense. The gist, very simple though. Good jobs, better life. Goes back to what I've said a number of times about, you know, when I was a kid. Union job, better life. Something I learned very early on. We had a neighbor. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were where they put the socioeconomic ladder on top of. And I'd say all the time, look, there were, you wouldn't know it, but when I was a kid, cupboards were bare a lot of the times. We were struggling. And that job that the neighbor got, working at Ford, a UAW job, at the time, the gold standard of the American working class, their lives immediately got better. They had food at the end of the month. Their kids had bikes, better clothes. They got a secondhand car. Eventually, they moved up and out. They left the projects. And I remember as a kid going, you know, how do we do that? And again, union job, better life. So when I had the opportunity to get a union job, you know, when I was a young man, jumped at it. And as a 19-year-old starting to work in, you know, and doing dock work and, you know, and working for doing warehouse work, the wages gave me the opportunity to build a solid life. And the thing is, I want that for everybody. But I was thinking about it today that, you know, when I started working, this is back in the mid to late 80s, union density in this country was about 25%. That means that everybody, out of everybody working, a quarter of the workers had unions. And a quarter of the workers benefited from those unions by having raised standards and benefits. And I would argue the whole society did, because the eight-hour day was something that it was the norm. Granted, unions had fought, bled, and died for that right. They inculcated it in all of their contracts. And everybody benefited from it. The weekends, something else unions fought for, something else we took for granted. And benefited everyone, union, non-union, didn't matter. But everyone knew somebody who was in a union. Everyone had a neighbor or a relative or a friend who was a union member. And they saw, hey, wow, that's a good job you got there. And that's been destroyed over the last 40 plus years. Conservative supply side voodoo Reaganomics brought us this. Desperation wage jobs, people struggling to make ends meet, and division. And I say all the time, if we're going to reunite this country, we've got to reunionize it. We've got to claw back some of the wealth that we create. And we've got to do it in a way that ensures that we all do better. The CEO all the way down to the person sweeping the floor. And look, that means everybody. But I was thinking about where we are today. I started off with 25% union density in this country. In the industry that I've spent, you know, the mass of my working life, back then when I started was 85% unionized. I fast forward all these years later, and the reality is we're 6% in the private sector union density. The industry that I work in is about 10%. And wages have been stagnant and declining. Benefits have been disappearing. Working conditions have been getting worse across every industry. And there was a time when virtually every industry had a voice, had a representative. I talk about my grandparents. My grandmother worked as a cashier at a small department store in Cleveland, represented by Local 880 of the UFCW. My grandfather was a truck driver, Teamsters Local 407. They built lives that saw their children go on and lead productive lives. They retired with dignity. They spent their golden years together in their home without desperation, without poverty, without hunger. And I look to the future and you go, how do you rebuild this? And I say all the time, the way forward, the way to solve our problems is in the workplace, by grabbing some of the wealth that our labor creates and holding on to it. So when we come back, I'm going to talk to our good friend Hamilton Nolan. He's a labor reporter, and he's written a piece on what needs to happen to revive the labor movement, to reunite this country, and to bring us all back together. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. I want to hear your thoughts. Something I said got you thinking. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, as I said earlier, you know, when I entered the workforce as a 19-year-old dock worker, union density in this country was about 25% across all industries. The industry that I was in, the LTL, less than truckload industry, 85% unionized. You fast forward to 30 some odd years later, and you're looking at, what, about 6% union density in the private sector, and in the industry that I'm in, about 10%. And what you've seen over that period of time are stagnant and declining wages, disappearing benefits, health, retirement, and worsening working conditions. And I say this all the time. If we're going to reunite this country, if we're going to bring us back together, it's got to be about reunionizing the country. And to do that, we need to build a bold, militant worker movement. And how are we going to do it? Well, my next guest says ambition. And ambition is something we most certainly need. That's why I've asked Hamilton Nolan to come talk with us. He is one of my favorite labor journalists. He's got a great Substack page, How Things Work. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Hamilton, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, man. Always good to be here.
So I go back to this all the time. You know, when I started working in this country, heavily unionized, about a quarter of the workers were in unions across industries. The one I was in was overwhelmingly unionized. And what we've seen is a destruction of what built that prosperous working class of my grandparents' generation to where now we got gig work and desperation labor. But we're in a moment, man. There's something that possibly could spark, and you're saying it's all about ambition is how we get it back.
We're definitely in a moment, you know, and everybody in the union world has been talking about this moment that we're in since the pandemic and the conclusion of the pandemic and how everybody got mad through the pandemic and the essential workers got energized and everybody saw the value of organized labor and everybody saw Starbucks and Amazon, you know, all of these things. Biden administration is labor friendly. We're definitely in a moment, you know, and I'm glad that you talked about union density, because to me, that collapse of union density is like the most important statistic possibly in all of America's underlying all of our social problems, you know, and it always blows my mind that people don't talk about union density more, especially in the mainstream press, because you can trace all of America's problems since, you know, Ronald Reagan era to that collapse of union density, particularly the rise of inequality, you know, that has led to all the crazy kind of politics we have now. So, you know, when you combine those two things, this, you know, this collapse in union density that has led to the inequality that is screwing up a lot of things in our politics, and the fact that we are in this moment when public opinion polls say, that, you know, the vast majority of Americans are pro-union now, tens of millions of workers say they want unions. And then you say, like, what's the missing ingredient here? The missing ingredient is the labor movement itself unionizing all those people, right? Because, you know, the unions aren't going to spontaneously form themselves. So what, you know, people like me and you and others of us in the labor movement are always looking for is, like, where is the energy coming from inside the union world to go out and really start organizing at that large scale and take advantage of this moment before it passes, possibly. And, you know, so I wrote this week, and a lot of people wrote this week, about the UAW in particular, made a big announcement that they were planning to organize not just one or two, but every non-union auto company in America.
That should be the goal.
150,000, yeah, 150,000 workers they're targeting. They're like, you know, I actually interviewed Sean Thain right before Thanksgiving, and I said, you know, what is your next organizing target? Is it Tesla? Is it the non-union plants down south, you know, which
yes,
obviously are a big problem? Right. And he was like, I don't care. And I thought he was kind of avoiding the question, but then a week later they came out and they were like, no, we're going for all of it. And it's like such a, you know, it's so heartening to see that, because the UAW, I feel like right now more than any other union, are the ones who are going out and saying, we are going to attack the scale of this problem. You know, our solution is going to be as big as the problem is.
And well, so in reality, in truth be told, and this is when we went out to Toledo, when we went out to Michigan and walked on the picket line with the workers who were striking, those workers knew that this could be one of the last contracts, because as you're looking at automation, as you're looking at changing in technology and changing of products, their jobs could be, their days could be numbered. So if they're not going to organize, if they're not going to grab everybody else, if they're not going to reclaim the industry, their days are kind of numbered, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are existential threats, right? Both of the, you know, Tesla, which is a incredibly well-funded, rich, big, growing company that is completely anti-union and is run by the richest guy in the world who is extremely anti-union. That's an existential threat to the power of the UAW. And the fact that every auto worker or every auto company on earth can go and locate plants in southern states and keep unions out is also an existential threat. So both those things are existential threats. And they, you know, what they said was after their strike was successful, they got thousands of incoming leads from other auto workers around the country in all of those places saying, we want to get in. And, you know, as you know, if you've been involved in organizing, like, you really have to grab those organizing opportunities. You know, you can't just let those things float around and not grab them. So
yeah, it's rare they come to you.
Right. They're coming to you. They're knocking on the door of the union saying, help us. And like, as a surprising number of unions will let those things die on the vine, man. And it really breaks my heart every time I see that. But that happens way more than it should. But, you know, I feel like what we're seeing UAW is them saying, they're rising to the occasion of what the workers are asking for. You know, all those workers want to be able to get those same kind of contracts. And the union, for their own part, needs it. The union needs those workers. They need to be in those plants if they're going to maintain their power. So it's like, now is the time, man.
But it comes back to something you talked about a moment ago. You know, if you want to solve a lot of our societal problems, I say this all the time. If we're going to change this country, if we're going to reunite this country, if we're going to solve some big problems, I think we have to do it by reorganizing workplaces. Because a lot of issues that we're divided on today, a lot of the outrage candy that's thrown at us by the right, we solved in the workplace years ago. I look at the transgender issue. 30 years ago in my workplace, this was not an issue. We had Ross, who went away, came back as Rosie, and you know who cared? Nobody.
Right.
It was not a huge deal. And yeah, it was because, you know, Rosie came, did her job, went home, led her life. That was it. And now we're ripped apart because we're no longer finding ground to find common. And I think in the workplace, having a union environment is not just good for the workplace, but it's good for society as a whole.
I mean, I absolutely agree, you know, and there's so, you know, part of it, it's a cycle that feeds on itself, because as union density has declined, fewer people are involved in unions and fewer people even think about unions and fewer people tie our problems today to the decline of unions because they don't have any experience of being in unions and seeing how unions can solve a lot of those things.
And the only thing they hear is bad. I mean, that's, you know, they've been, right. we are now living through, you know, 40 years of right-wing messaging into workers' ears, which are, you know, unions are job killers. They put companies out of business and they're greedy, greedy. Ask any union member what their union means to them. And what it means is better wages, hours, conditions, better opportunities, job security, family security. It means a lot of the things that make our lives better. And right, that message doesn't get told enough, in my view.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's ironic because if you think about the golden era of American prosperity, what people kind of always harken back to, you know, the like post-World War II era, the baby boom era, you know, from 1948 to 1980 or so. That shared prosperity, it was the greatest shared prosperity that this country or any country on earth has ever seen. And what was it that allowed that prosperity to be shared and to create that middle class? Well, it was the strength of labor, you know, that was enabled by strong unions that forced that prosperity to be spread around. And what we've seen since 1980 and since the Reagan era is collapse of unions. There's not enough labor power for workers to keep their share of the gains. All the gains go to the top 1%. And what does it do? It kills the middle class. It makes people cynical. It undermines people's belief in American institutions, and it leads to places like Donald Trump. I mean, I really think that's a really straightforward story that needs to be talked about more in the mainstream media, because I think a lot of people aren't even conscious of what they've lost.
You know? No, I mean, and the thing is, and maybe you'll agree with me, and this was my premise from the very beginning, and the reason in April of 16 I said Trump was going to win. He tapped into, yeah, the racists, the homophobes, the misogynists, all that. Yeah, okay, fine. But what he tapped into was those folks, their memory of what it used to be like when you had those union jobs, when those factories lined Brook Park Avenue in Cleveland, when the Ford and the Chevy plant were pumping out automobiles, and all the feeder plants that had good jobs and union wages were feeding into that. They thought of, he's going to bring that back. And that's what I believe he tapped into more than anything, was he got working people to believe, hey, somebody's going to bring that factory back. Akron's going to bring rubber back. Toledo is going to have glass again. I know people who believed it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I mean, it goes without saying that Donald Trump is a lying scumbag, but you know, it's really cool to see somebody like Sean Fain today who is essentially saying the same thing, right? But actually doing it, and they're coming back and they're reopening plants that got shut down. You know, and they're winning those things in the contracts against the big three. And now they're taking this next step of going out and saying, we're going to spread this to everybody because everybody deserves it. Like, these are the steps that actually need to happen, not just for the labor movement, but like you said, for America itself, to get us out of this 40-year hole.
Yeah. And now, so what I find interesting about your piece, and I hope people will go to your Substack page, howthingswork.substack.com, is you talk about all the other industries. My grandmother worked in a department store. It was unionized.
Yeah.
Everybody, insurance agents, all this stuff. We could be doing more.
Right. Yeah, I mean, UAW is taking advantage of the strength they had coming out of that strike, and they're leveraging that to go do new organizing. And that, again, is a thing that too many unions don't do. And there's so many industries, you know, healthcare, any industry. I mean, my own union, the Writers Guild, I'm in the Writers Guild East, just had obviously a really long strike this summer along with SAG-AFTRA. All of Hollywood was on strike, shut it down, tons of publicity. You know, won the strike. And now it's like they need to do the same thing that UAW is doing. You need to seize that momentum and go out and take the union to the people that don't have it.
Yep.
Because it's real easy to for those of us who are in the union to sit back and pat ourselves on the back and say we won all this stuff. But we always got to think of society as a whole, right? Like you said, 10%, only 10% of people have a union in the first place. Like, what are we doing out here?
No, look, when I was a kid, you know, I saw this growing up. And talked about it earlier. You know, union job, better life. That was the message. When that neighbor got that job at Ford, their lives got better. Food at the end of the month. You know, better clothes, better car. Moved out of the projects altogether. You know, union job, better life. That's the message. Very simple bumper sticker. Something the right wing knows something about. Maybe we could pick up on. But again, I go back to this idea that it's not just about auto workers. It's not just about truck drivers. It's about people in every industry, from healthcare to education to insurance agents to waiters and waitresses, to you name it.
Right.
Every worker should have a contract like every CEO does.
Right. And there, you know, what I try to touch on in my piece too, was there's a lot of industries like the auto industry where you have strong unions in the industry already. But you don't have that density, you know? So for example, the grocery industry, right? UFCW is in the grocery industry. They have hundreds of thousands of grocery workers. They have major grocery companies organized. But if you look at the grocery industry as a whole, it's not like it has 80% union density. You know, it has it's a minority union density status. And like, there's not anything really separating that situation from what the UAW has. You know, the UAW has a part of their industry, their strong in a part of the industry, and now they are affirmatively taking the step to be like, we are going to spread through our industry because we need to have the power in the industry. You know, there's tons of unions that can do that. There's tons of unions that are in the same position, essentially, that the UAW is in the auto industry. And the only difference that I can tell the UAW is like they have the attitude and the leadership that they want to do it, you know.
So let me ask you a last question on that, because since you brought that up, is that leadership or is that membership? Because I keep saying we're in a moment where you've got some militant labor activists where members are demanding more, coming out of the pandemic, being told that they were important, that they were essential, that they were frontline heroes, that their work mattered, only to find out, that was all BS.
Right.
And now they're ticked about it. So I guess it's a chicken egg thing. But is it as much leadership as it is militancy, or how do you see it?
Yeah, it's obviously both. I mean, you're right. Cause look, a guy like Sean Fain, who was a reformer who came in and won, he doesn't win without the membership behind him, you know, and they had to go through that process of reforming the union and getting one member, one vote in the union to open up the possibility of having some democratic accountability in that union. I actually just got back from Seattle, where I was reporting a story about UFCW and the reformers inside of UFCW who are trying to start the process of doing the same thing that was done inside UAW, inside the UFCW. And, you know, it's a hard process because the unions have all these rules that make it very hard to have democratic accountability and insulates the leadership of the union from the sort of one member, one vote thing that propelled Sean Fain into his seat in the first place. So it's a long process, but just the fact that those things are happening inside other unions goes to show that, like, the members want that. The members see that. And I guess you could say the leader is the final piece of that chain, you know, but obviously it starts with the members saying, why can't our union do what we wanted to do?
Good stuff. And I agree with your final conclusion. It's time for them to spend money on organizing. It's time to go for broke. I'm right there with you. But Hamilton, I appreciate the time. Great work. Hope folks will check out the Substack page, howthingswork.substack.com. We'll get links out on social media. Hamilton Nolan, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it, man.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, revitalize, reunite, reunionize. That's the secret sauce. And I think this is what Joe Biden's been talking about his entire presidency. How do we make sure that the work that we do is rewarded? And look, I'm thrilled with the things that the Biden administration has done in reshoring manufacturing, promoting people to, well, do what the National Labor Relations Act says should be done, promote unionism, get people joining and forming. And as we just talked about with Hamilton Nolan, our history, the history of building the most prosperous working class in history, well, it was all about making unions stronger. Pretty simple stuff. And we can do it. We most certainly can. For our television audience, thanks so much for tuning in. Great having you here. Want to hear from you. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something I said got you thinking. Maybe you want to join a union. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. For our radio audience, we're right back after this. Stick around.
the number one selling product of its kind with over 20 years of research and innovation. Botox Cosmetic, onabotulinum toxin A, is a prescription medicine used to temporarily make moderate to severe frown lines, crow's feet, and forehead lines look better in adults.
Effects of Botox Cosmetic may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness may be a sign of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Don't receive Botox Cosmetic if you have a skin infection. Side effects may include allergic reactions, injection site pain, headache, eyebrow and eyelid drooping, and eyelid swelling. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Tell your doctor about medical history, muscle or nerve conditions including ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis, or Lambert-Eaton syndrome and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects. For full safety information, visit BotoxCosmetic.com or call 877-351-0300.
See for yourself at BotoxCosmetic.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, evidently, the big debate. Did you know there's a debate going on? Yeah, there's a debate going on. The Republicans are having the children's debate. What's his name? Vivek Ramaswamy, Nikki Haley, the guy from Florida that got wiped up, got the floor wiped up with him, DeSantis, and I guess Chris Christie, too. They've let him come along. Going to be the big debates going on, and no one's watching. I'm not watching. I think you probably should just save your time. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, well, the big debate or the child's debate and where we are, what we're doing, how things are in America, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So what do you make of the big debate that, look, I think this one, when they look at the numbers, this one will be the one that gets the worst numbers ever.
Probably, and it's down in Alabama. But of course, this is the what I call the just-in-case debate. And so people are hanging on to this, the four of them, now down to four. And of course, the goal, which would be my goal if I was there doing this right now, would be to knock out one of them. And if I was Nikki Haley, I'd try to forget Chris Christie and knock out DeSantis. That's exactly what I would do.
Because right DeSantis is not doing well.
It's not going to take too hard of a hit to get him out.
No, I think he's dumb to get out. But I do think he's the most vulnerable because he's really not done well. I mean, you look at that, you look at the debate or whatever that was with Governor Newsom of California. He didn't do well. Didn't do well at all.
Well, I did not understand why he even did that, Rick, because number one, if you looked at Newsom's performance against Hannity, and I know everybody said, oh, California is in turmoil, exactly, you know, this and that. Forget that for a second. If you look at how he handled himself against Hannity, everybody recognized that, wow, you know, he was good. Newsom had, I think, nothing to lose by doing the debate. Puts him out front. He's in a, you know, limelight position, kind of a top contender, you know, speaking for the administration.
Yep.
But DeSantis had a lot to lose because DeSantis just couldn't look okay. He had to shine, you know, against Newsom. So I don't even understand why he did. I think DeSantis is next. A couple shows I do, one of them, somebody, you know, texted in and said that I was insane, that, you know, there's no way DeSantis is going to take it all, and he's not. So this is the just-in-case group. And again, if I was Nikki Haley or Ramaswamy or Christie, my objective would be to damage as much as humanly possible DeSantis.
Yeah. No, I think they will all go after him, or at least they should. But here's the other part of this. I don't really care about what they're doing because I don't think Trump is going anywhere. I think he's going to be the nominee. And I think, you know, we have to figure out how to make sure that he doesn't become, well, the next president. But here's the scary thing, though. And you, I don't know if you've been paying attention to this, but you know, the narrative going out is, well, there's an enthusiasm gap, especially among young people, because young people just, you know, they're not enthused, Bob.
Well, correct. And what I think is going to happen, if it continues, is not just when you look at the polls. You look at, you know, I don't think something's going to turn them around in particular, but just 49% of 18 to 29-year-olds are definitely planning on voting, which is down from 57% to 49.
Right.
It's down on the Republican side also. So it's not just, you know, just the Democratic side. Young black Americans are seeing a decline, with 38% saying they will definitely vote next year. Used to be 50% in 2019, from 50 to 38. These are not small drops. These are big in the political world today, you know. Hispanic Americans had a steep drop, 40% say they will definitely vote, compared to what used to be 56%. So you get down the list. And again, 56% of Republicans said they will definitely vote. That is a 10-point drop from 2019. Now, President Biden, for good news, temporarily, holds an 11-point lead over former President Trump. However, we all know that President Biden has lost significant ground, especially when it comes to the Israel-Hamas war. He's lost some ground with young people and young progressive Democrats. But also on top of it, the bigger problem he has, you know, is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., but Cornel West. That's the biggest problem. And if Joe Manchin runs, you know, on the, you know, independent ticket, anything that peels off to those candidates, especially Cornel West, is a vote for Trump.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. There was a good hit piece on, an interesting hit piece on Cornel West. I think it was last week or the week before. You know, do you know why Cornel West is broke? It's because he's got a whole other family. And there's this whole story about, you know, how he's had, you know, this sideline family and this secret and all of this stuff. And I'm like, you know, this is what happens when you run for president. This kind of stuff. It's part of the reason my wife never wanted me to run for office. I don't even know what skeletons are in my closet. I'm sure there are some. I went through a couple of years playing in a band, drinking a little bit more than I should have, doing some things they probably shouldn't have. I don't know that I want my kids to know about it, because nothing ever seems to go away when you run for office.
Well, one of the best ones, and I'll make this real quick. I was on the Congressional Campaign Committee for the Republicans when I was in the House, and this candidate comes in. I'll spare his name, but he comes in and he says, "Hey, I did opposition research on myself, and here it is." And he lays it on the desk in front of three of us. I've been in politics a long time, and I'm looking through it. I'm like, I'm gasping, all right? And I'm like, who's seen this? And he said, oh, just my campaign treasurer, two of my consultants, and a fundraiser. I said, okay, thank you.
You're done.
See you later.
But there's something to be said to getting out ahead of all of your negatives. Own up to being, you know, a horrible person. Say, look, you know,
I think this guy gave them information they couldn't have ever found. All right.
Yeah, well, there is that.
Wow.
Well, yeah, look, he was just trying to be honest, Bob.
Right, right.
Just trying to do the right thing.
So these young voters it just shows across the board, Republican, Democrat, they don't have enthusiasm. And you've been around a long, long time. You know you can have numbers and support. If you don't get them out to vote, yep. You don't have the numbers and support, that means nothing.
Yeah.
They have to, you gotta have some enthusiasm. This is a strange political world right now, so this doesn't look good.
But the campaign, you know, the Biden campaign hasn't really, you know, started yet. I mean, they haven't done anything they've literally done nothing to promote what they've done, in my view. And they've done a lot. There's a lot of good stuff that they should be running on, that we should be seeing more about. Sadly, we're just not, at least I'm not seeing it. Maybe they're trying and I'm not seeing it. I don't know.
No, you know, my job is to research news, and, you know, I call radio stations, and yeah, it's my job to do it. And there are things that, you know, I know from digging into things, stories that people may think, well, the president did something on pharmaceutical, didn't he? You know, and I have to think what he did do. He did some great things, but I have to think, what did he do? You know, because they just haven't publicized it enough.
And what's interesting to me, Bob, and this is where in talking with Trump supporters, there are a number of them who believe that what the things that Biden has done, they believe Trump did it. The infrastructure bill, you know, some of the manufacturing that's being brought back on shore, the prescription drug thing, only because during you know, the time Trump was in office and the time he campaigned, you know, he said he was going to do all these things. And we had, what, infrastructure week every week, just no real infrastructure during Trump's presidency.
Right. First thing Trump should have done out of the box after he got done with the oath of office was the infrastructure bill.
$3 trillion bill. And I said that on Inauguration Day. He comes out with a $3 trillion infrastructure bill. He will be president forever.
Right. And he would have made goodwill.
Yep.
Hopefully would have seen that. You know, the Congress, for the most part, loves these bills. And he really could have set a tone. Instead, you know, he was doing his infighting with his own people, et cetera, which continued on and would happen again. You know, positions that he'll pick people and then he'll hate them, which is what he does.
Oh boy, does he ever. But his thin skin and his paranoia is what really caused him to not be even a good president, in my view. He could have been. He could have been a good president. He could have chosen to go in a direction and do the things he ran on. And you and I agree on something, you know, that in 2016, had it not been Hillary, had Hillary not been the candidate, had it been Bernie Sanders, Bernie would have won because those were the issues that were important. It was about infrastructure. It was about jobs. It was about bringing back that faith and working hard, playing by the rules and getting ahead that Trump kind of tapped into and gave people some false hope that he was. In fact, I actually met a guy from Lordstown, from the Lordstown plant up in near Youngstown, who did not move when they shut that plant down because he truly believed Trump was going to keep that place open. So he was going to stay and he was going to fight, and he's out of a job.
Right. Well, I had went to a Union Hall. They had invited me down there. He wanted to say thank you, actually, for you know, past work I did when I was in office, but also they wanted to pick my brain on a couple pieces of legislation they had. How did I think they should, you know, traverse them through the Congress and things? So I went down there. Then they had their general meeting. They said, would you like to stay? I said, sure. And all of a sudden, when I heard the talk of endorsements and what I heard them say, which was not, oh, wow, Trump's the savior, but that Hillary, after she gets elected, will do every trade bill humanly possible.
Yep.
That's what I heard from the union.
No, you know, look, I interviewed her in 2016. And what she gave me was, you know, we're gonna have a trade prosecutor. That was her grand scheme. I don't know if you remember this, but her grand scheme was we're gonna enforce the what's in the trade agreements. You know, we're gonna finally stand up because the steel workers were going after trade cases left and right, and we just weren't helping. So it was her grand idea that we were gonna bring in a trade prosecutor who was gonna stand up for them. I'm like, these trade deals are just bad. Can't we just go away from them?
Well, I was with Mark Galyptus and United Steelworkers of America, Independent Steelworkers Union. 10,000 of us walked down the street of D.C. past the Treasury, yelling at the treasurer. Clinton was president. We blocked the gates of the White House, all of them, and they came out and very politely said, "Could you please unblock the gates?" And they let me into the White House, and they said, "What do you want?" And it was Lamb was the guy's name, who was one of the advisors for Clinton. And I said, "There's 10,000 Democrats out there that would like their jobs." That's what I told him. And we just couldn't get movement. Bush came and gave it 201. It was all too late in the process, you know.
Yeah.
But we just couldn't get movement. And at the time, I thought, what doesn't add up? Democrats, you know, not supporting a 201 action to help steal. But Hillary, everybody knew it. She likes trade bills.
This is true. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst. I got to get your thoughts on Ohio, your senator there. You know, anti-big government guy. You know, the Biden administration's weaponizing government against the people. Evidently, he's part of this College Admission Accountability Act that they're promoting. And evidently what they're going to do is, I think it's through the Department of Education, if I'm getting this right, they're going to create a special inspector general for unlawful discrimination in higher investigation. And their job is to investigate any college admission department that fails to comply with the Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action. And I'm going, I don't know, is that not kind of weaponizing government a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a real strange piece of legislation because the Supreme Court, of course, when they acted on the affirmative action, we actually found out that there were many colleges that never even reported in the first place.
Right.
That's what, you know, was at least the information I got when the court case came.
Right, because most colleges have an open enrollment situation.
Well, right.
To where it doesn't matter. We're talking about the handful of elite schools where you have this enormous competition. You're talking a handful.
Right. So most of them didn't have to worry about it. Nobody worried about them, right? Now, if this bill passes, it would make a condition of eligibility for student assistance, but be federal money, and any aid to the universities, whatever, development or, you know, building funds or whatever, that they would have to be part of 100% the Equal Protection Clause and Title VI, you know, which is the racial discrimination and preference. So, yes, you're right. It would create a special inspector general for unlawful discrimination in higher education. Now, what's interesting, when you listen to what the inspector general is, well, for unlawful discrimination, right? But what the inspector general is going to do is try to go out and enforce the Supreme Court's ruling, and then it would create this whole process for anybody applying and the university employees to file allegations against admission departments. They would be allowed to recommend corrective actions and then institute the penalties, you know, under this inspector general. So, I mean, I'm looking and I'm thinking, you know, it's one thing if you say we're going to see if you've discriminated against people. It's another if you say we're going to set up this process to make sure you can discriminate against people.
Yeah, that's what it's, that's what it sounds like to me. Now, the weird thing is, J.D. Vance, a Yale graduate, his children aren't going to have to worry about that because legacy still is something that's perfectly okay. Yeah. So,
yes,
as I understand, his kids don't have to worry about any of this. They're grandfathered in. They're legacied in.
Exactly. Yes.
I don't see any legislation on that.
I mean, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but it's interesting.
And finally, got to get your thoughts on, do you have an exit plan in the event that Trump is elected? You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's, you know, a big, well-known commentator, and he said, you know, Vancouver is where he's, you know, privately, he's told me Vancouver is, if Trump's elected, he's going, because as we know, Trump's running on retribution and payback and patronage and all of this stuff. And Kash Patel, one of Trump's guys, was on the Bannon podcast where he said that he's going to be Trump's next CIA director. And when he's the CIA director, he's going to lead patriots, he said, appointed by Trump to go after people like you and me. His quote was, "We will find the conspirators in government and the media." Yes, we are going to come after people in the media. So are you concerned that, maybe back to jail?
Well, you know, that makes me think. I mean, all they've got to do is listen to you and I a few times on a podcast, and I don't know, we might have to pick somewhere to go to. Not sure where.
But
at least hide for a while, maybe.
Can you believe that they're saying this stuff out loud? And I mean, I know the Heritage Foundation's got their 2025 plan, and I've seen the application that I don't think there's anywhere on there that says, are you qualified to do the job? But it seems like, you know, they're running on, hey, we're going to be fascistic. Hey, we're going to make patronage great again.
Well, also, there's a dovetail to this where, and people are already applying, and this dovetails right into this of what Patel, because, you know, Patel was sitting and waiting to become CIA director with one of the nominees if they ran into problems. He was already waiting under Trump at one point in time. But the dovetail to this is this whole list they are accumulating as we speak of resumes. And I went through people, you know, with the new president, oh, here we want to put our resume in. We have an EPA background. We'd like to apply for something. You know, congressional offices got those calls all the time. Well, I saw the sheets you fill out because they put them on Axios, and I saw the sheets, and it asks you, what social media have you used?
Yep.
What have you posted? You know, are you loyal to Trump? It doesn't even ask you what your expertise is. They're just going to place people, as the article said, that will say yes. So if you have no EPA background and they put you in EPA, number one, you're probably going to mess it all up anyway because you don't know what you're doing. But number two, when the White House calls and says that man and woman running that company in Carlisle, they were really bad-mouthing Trump, why don't you cite them?
Go get them. Yeah, no. This guy
or girl's got this job. They're going to go get him.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to happen.
So, like I said, do you have an exit plan? I told this person, I go, look, I'm going to stay and fight. If they lock me up, that's where I go, because I love this country. And that's not just, you know, that's just not, you know, words. At this point, if something happens, you're going to have to stay. We may have to stay and defend our country. Scary times, Bob. Scary stuff. But always, always great stuff. Appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, you too, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Nay, former Ohio congressman, political analyst. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at therickSmithShow.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So look, I look at this Kash Patel thing as serious. When he says, look, I'm going to be the next CIA director. I am going to lead the patronage patriots that Trump puts into office on an all-out effort to go after people like me, people like Bob, people who are willing to speak up in times of turmoil, people who are willing to advocate for a better future, where they're going to go after, prosecute, and jail people who in government who just want to do their jobs. Now, this is the thing that's interesting to me. And for my AFGE friends, they are talking about firing every single AFG member if they want to. This Schedule F plan that they've got, this idea that they can fire anybody they want for any reason whatsoever, and replace them with people who, well, their only qualification is being loyal. And the question I ask people, you know, this election cycle, is that what you're voting for? You know, it's one thing to say, well, you know, I don't like Rick and I want to see bad things happen to him. It's another thing to say, no, I want to have a country where whoever gets elected has the power to impose their will on everyone. Now, you know, Mitch McConnell loves to remind everyone, you know, we're a country that protects the voice of the minority and then goes on to, you know, crush the minority every chance he gets. But it's good rhetoric. This is literally saying that they're going to go after people who don't agree with them. And the media. And look, it's easy to pick on government and media. It really is. They rarely fight back. And it's owned by corporate America, where most of our problems come from. So to see this, it kind of makes me go, will the American people stand up for a government like this that's saying, you know what, and admitting it? This is the part that gets me. This is the part that I'm having a struggle with. They're honest. They're telling us what they want to do, what their wet dream list is. They're open, blatant. They're telegraphing their punches. Now, look, I do know some people who go, "Yeah, that's good. We need to get rid of some of these people. Let's arrest them," without thinking that, you know what, they could be next. That they could be next on the list of people that they come after. You know, I go back to that Pastor Niemöller quote. You know, first they came for the trade unionists and I said nothing because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the socialists and I said nothing because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the Jews and I said nothing because I wasn't Jewish. And by the time they came for me, there was no one left to speak up. Eventually, when you give people this kind of unchecked authoritarian power on either side of the equation, look, I'm a middle of the road guy. I believe in curbs. I believe in boundaries. I believe in checks and balances. I believe in all that stuff that I was taught in high school government class that helps keep our nation going somewhat in the same direction. This idea of having wild banana republic kind of swings should scare every person, regardless if whoever it is saying it is wearing the hat that you're wearing. And I know we've loved this idea of red hat, blue hat, and you know, my team, your team, I win, you lose. I know we like that, those binary situations, but the reality is eventually, what's that, live by the sword, die by the sword? This is where we're going. And I'm concerned, as every single American should be, as every working person should be, that we will be at the behest of the handful. The unwashed masses. We will be the ones pitted against each other. We will be the ones that suffer. While the Trumps of the world and the Cash Patels, they get to play games. For them, this is kind of a game, if anything else. And who ends up taking the brunt of it? Well, we do. Because where are their ideas to solve climate, debt, healthcare, retirement security? As we talked about earlier in the week, long-term healthcare for seniors that are people who are becoming seniors, and where are they going to live in their final day? Where are the ideas? Where are the solutions? Where are the plans to any of that stuff? Where is the agenda to fight to make people's lives better? Where is the agenda to help, ensure that we, the working people, have good jobs, safe jobs, good wages, good benefits? Where's that plan? I know. It's in the super secret safe, along with their great health care and their climate plan and all that stuff. It's in the super secret safe. It's on the unmarked pages. Wake up, folks. Time to get active and engaged. Want to hear your thoughts. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, wherever your favorite podcasts are. You'll get ours. And email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Thanks for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's. We help. You save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, the host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a show that mixes history, culture, politics, famous people, and booze, and strains it through the cognitive mesh of my sozzled gray matter. Join me each week as I take a lighthearted stroll through the consequential role that alcohol has played through the ages, and how it shaped key moments in history, quite literally changing the world. For instance, did you know that Thomas Jefferson started the first U.S. wine company in Virginia with investments from George Washington and Ben Franklin? It's true. And if you're wondering whose winery sits across the street from Jefferson's estate today, here's a hint. What's orange, president, and has a very good brain and the best people. I'll also tell you about new stuff to drink, trends, recipes, and other things that are good to know. And I'll chat up celebrities, along with the movers and shakers of the adult beverage world. And since this is a show about alcohol, I'd like to remind you that drinking can cause memory loss. Or even worse, memory loss. Where was I? Oh, right. Plugging my show. It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. It's fun, I promise. So come on, pull up a bar stool, and let's kick it.